You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
From the heart of where innovation, money, and power collide, in Silicon Valley and beyond, this is Bloomberg Technology with Emily Chang.
I'm Emily Chang in San Francisco, and this is Bloomberg Technology. Coming up in the next hour, Snap shares snap back after a short fall in late trading following its first quarterly results. Why the company is saying advertisers are pulling back. Plus, Elon Musk just got a little closer to making his Twitter dream a reality, all thanks to some pretty big backers on Wall Street. We'll tell you who they are. And Netflix shares keep plunging. Now, CNN Plus announcing it's shutting down. Is it a sign that streaming has peaked? We'll talk about that. I want to stick with Snap now, the company reporting sales falling short of estimates, saying advertisers pulled back on spending in the days following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Rohit Kulkarni of MKM Partners with us now to discuss. Rohit, is that it?
I think they are giving us a lot of numbers. They are seeing what happened before Feb 23rd, what happened through March 31st, what's happening through April. And I think what they're trying to tell us is things got a little bit worse during March, but that they are not getting more worse. They are definitely a leg down from what they expected themselves to be. But I think your quarter-to-date data seems to indicate that they are not getting more worse. And the guidance for 2Q, they, at least this is the story that they want us to hear, is we are expecting more worse trends, and hence we are a little bit more conservative. So that's why the stock went down 20 to up 5 because of this narrative that seems to be sticking with investors.
So is this a story that's going to repeat itself with Twitter earnings, with Meta?
Again, every company has their own flavor of advertisers that they work with. What is incrementally slightly more negative for companies that work with brand advertisers, Snap is calling that out here, that brand advertisers were much slower during March, and they pulled back very quickly. And if you look at Facebook versus Twitter versus Pinterest, I think Twitter is the one that overskews towards brand advertisers. So if what Snap is telling is really applicable to everybody else, then Twitter is probably the one that is going to see a more negative trends. And Facebook and Pinterest may not as much.
Meantime, Twitter has a lot of other drama to deal with. And I know you also cover Twitter. What do you think about Elon Musk as a buyer? Do you like this?
I think there are just a lot of hurdles, logistical, financial diligence, and just the overall kind of how he gets the board to approve this current offer. I think this is going to be a drama. It's going to be a ping pong match over the next, call it 3, 6, 9 months. I don't see a very clear and very immediate resolution, in my opinion. I think there are too many variables. Macro environment is weakening. So probably Elon Musk may have second thoughts as we see the earnings kind of unfold.
So does that make Twitter a dangerous or risky stock to own right now?
Given what we are hearing from Snap right now, if brand advertisers are pulling back because of not just Ukraine, but just the confluence of all the macro headwinds we are seeing, interest rate hikes, inflation, supply chain uncertainty, Europe may have some issues, European consumer brand advertisers may have some issues. So I think Yeah, Twitter is the one that is going to probably face more issues, and we'll learn that over the next week or so.
In this Snap story, do you also see some of the problems Netflix is facing? People leaving their homes, not sitting on the couch all day, getting out and not, you know, sitting there on their phone watching Netflix or hanging out on Snapchat?
I think so. Isn't there, there is obviously a consumer behavior shift. The pendulum of consumer behavior did shift extremely to all these internet stocks and all these internet companies. And now we are seeing the pendulum swing way far away. People are sitting on flights, sitting on cruises, and just sitting away from their iPads and iPhones. So I feel at some point, once we get back to the new normal, we should see resumption of consumer behavior. But until then, I think all these companies that rely on engagement in front of your iPad, engagement in front of your iPhone, are going to see pockets of weakness. Netflix, again, is also probably at the mercy of this vertical video shift that we are seeing across internet. TikTok, Snap has its Spotlight, Instagram has its Reels, YouTube has its Shorts. So there is this shift towards short-form video, ad-supported video, and plus there's the pendulum shifting away from out-of-home kind of consumption. So they are in a slight air pocket. Hopefully, they recover.
I wonder how much competition you think Snap is seeing from TikTok in particular, given, you know, similar audiences and that we don't have as much visibility into TikTok's results. Like, how much is it? Is it really TikTok alone that's taking a bite here?
TikTok is definitely taking a bite from across the overall advertising ecosystem. It's not too small to be ignored right now. It is a much bigger force to reckon with, both from engagement, time spent on TikTok, as well as advertiser share of wallet perspective. I feel when we talk to a lot of ad agencies, TikTok is probably positioning itself as a linear TV sort of a brand advertiser friendly advertising engagement platform. So it is more closer to YouTube and a little bit farther away from Snap is what they're currently positioning. But again, I think TikTok is definitely something that is going to start to matter as they scale up. Still very early days.
All right. Rohit Kulkarni, MKM Partners, thank you so much. Lots to digest. Another story we continue to watch meantime, Florida's Republican-controlled legislature has passed a measure to strip Disney of special privileges in the state. This escalates a feud between Governor Ron DeSantis and the entertainment giant. The legislation could lead to the dissolution of the Reedy Creek Improvement District, where Disney has been allowed to carry out its own municipal functions on its own. It was already approved by the Senate, now goes to DeSantis for his signature. Elon Musk appears to be getting closer to making his attempt to own Twitter a reality. Bloomberg has learned Musk is now vetting potential investors. For more on it all, I am joined by Bloomberg's Michelle Davis, who reports on M&A for us, and David Kirkpatrick, founder of Techonomy. So, Michelle, what's the latest on how much funding Musk has actually pulled together at this point?
Yeah, so, I mean, you said it. It seems like he is serious about this. Today, he issued a filing that said he has raised $46.5 billion of financing. $25.5 billion of that is debt. Some of it's LBO debt, you know, from banks. It's going to be in the form of junk bonds and loans. And then part of that is also a margin loan that basically is, you know, a loan secured by his own Tesla shares. And then the other half was $21 billion of equity financing. That's just him basically promising that he's going to contribute equity to the offer. And so right now he's canvassing investors. You know, he doesn't have $21 billion of equity at the ready. He has about $3 billion. And so over the coming days, what he's going to be doing is talking to equity investors and kind of, you know, vetting them to figure out who he wants to participate in the bid with him.
David, the fact that we're even talking about whether or not Elon Musk is serious about a $43 billion bid he already said he planned to make is so ironic. I mean, the numbers here are just huge. How do you expect this all to continue to unfold?
If I knew how it was going to continue to unfold, I would be unusual, because I don't think anybody, even Elon Musk, really knows how it's likely to unfold. In fact, I was talking today to a very, very veteran investor, and I asked him what he thought, and he said, well, it depends on how Musk feels that day. If he feels good, he'll do it. If he doesn't feel good, he probably won't do it. I mean, that's pretty much the world we're in, where the world's richest man is incredibly whimsical and unpredictable and even silly. And I sort of revel in that, but it's not easy to predict what comes next.
So, Michelle, who are these investors who are willing to get into bed with somebody who is unpredictable on any given day?
So there's still a lot that we don't know, but what we do know is that there are 12 banks that have agreed to contribute the debt financing. Morgan Stanley, you know, has the biggest share of that. I think they're agreeing to put up $5.5 billion of debt. And then, you know, it's the Citigroups, Bank of America, Barclays, those kinds of big international banks. On the equity side, we know that Apollo is thinking about helping him. It's unclear what form that would take. But up until, you know, right now, we still don't know who else. It's gonna materialize over the coming days, is what we're told. So,
David, what do you imagine Jack Dorsey is thinking here? He's been rather cryptic, like initially supportive, then he himself tweeting about the dysfunction of Twitter's own board. Where, you know, whose side is Jack on?
Well, he voted for the poison pill. The company confirmed that. So we know that he's cautious about this deal as a manager and as a steward of his own shares and the company that he co-founded. My guess is that he's generally sympathetic to Musk, and a lot of the things that Musk says he would love to see happen if they were really possible, although not to completely abandon moderation, which is one of the things that Musk seems to be implying or saying that he might do. He doesn't say that straight out, but it sounds like he's interested in reducing moderation. But one thing that Jack did last week was he tweeted cryptically, everybody stop and hug. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean the people, the board of Twitter should hug Elon Musk or vice versa? Or, you know, that does suggest that probably he thinks a negotiated resolution is possible. But again, we are reading tea leaves here.
Is, Michelle, is there a potential for some sort of negotiated resolution? What might that look like?
Yeah, definitely. You know, when I've been talking to lawyers and bankers who are experts in this matter, they have been saying that every hostile bid always ends up as a friendly bid if it does turn into an actual deal. And so, you know, for this to work for Elon Musk, he needs the board to remove the poison pill, because even if he gets a tender offer done, like, a deal would be contingent on them removing that. So I do think for this to work, and now he's shown that, you know, he is serious about this offer, it is going to have to turn into something friendly. One other thing that I thought was interesting about today's amended filing was that he said his offer is no longer contingent on due diligence. So that means basically we don't need to look, you know, we don't need to look into your books. We could do a deal tomorrow. We have the financing here. Let's just do it. So, yeah.
David, you know, having covered social networking for so long, including the earliest days of Facebook, do you think that, that Twitter could change in a good way under Elon Musk's leadership? You know, like, do you like the idea of open sourcing the algorithm, for example?
That I do think is a good idea, probably, depending on how it was implemented. I think the idea of giving users more control over how they experience these social networks is a good idea. But even, you know, your either boss or longtime colleague Matt Winkler today or this week wrote a piece about what a brilliant manager Elon Musk is. He was talking primarily about Tesla. But look, you can't really bet against Elon Musk as a business decision maker. That would be very risky. It could be that he's willing with his own money to invest even more in algorithms, AI, other technology that might make managing Twitter better or easier. I liked his tweet today that he could get rid of the bots and authenticate all users. I think that's a very good idea. That would actually make Twitter more like Facebook, because Facebook was always intended to be an authenticated social network. You use your real name. Now, we know that isn't in fact what has happened entirely, but it's still the general design. I would like to see Twitter go in that direction.
Michelle, he's personally pledged $21 billion of his own equity. How much of that do you think, if a deal happens, he'd actually spend?
It all probably comes down to who he is able to convince to, you know, sign on to provide equity. So at this point, if he needed to do it tomorrow, he could do $3 billion unless he sold a bunch of his Tesla stock. It really depends on, you know, who decides to come on and what their conditions are for joining him. I think another thing that's notable about this whole situation is up until today, you know, there were some people who I don't think took this very seriously because there was a question around, you know, how he didn't have the financing. Now that he does, I think one thing that we're definitely keeping an eye on is, does this set in motion, you know, a chain of events where, as we've talked about before, you know, a potential white knight comes in to try to make an offer for Twitter, you know, to kind of save them from Elon Musk. Maybe there could have been, you know, some on the sidelines who weren't taking it seriously, but now that they see that Musk has the money, we might see them emerge.
Michelle Davis, Bloomberg, David Kirkpatrick of Techonomy. We will continue to watch how this all continues to unfold. Thank you. Let's get back to this week's top story, and that, of course, is Netflix. 3 days after losing subscribers for the first time in a decade, shares falling even further, down almost 4% on the day, extending a massive sell-off. I want to bring in Bloomberg's Jerry Smith for more on this. And Jerry, the big question is this just a blip? Is this a Netflix thing? Or is this the streaming business at its peak?
Yeah, I think that's what all the investors and media companies want to know right now. You know, not only did Netflix's stock decline after this, but, you know, Warner Brothers Discovery and other media companies that have made big bets on streaming also saw their shares fall. And I think investors are wondering if Netflix is now starting to hit its head on the ceiling of how many subscribers there are in the streaming business. So what does that mean for Disney Plus? What does that mean for HBO Max? You know, these are the entire media industry really transformed its business and went all in on streaming because Netflix was so successful. If Netflix is starting to hit a wall, you know, that's bad news for everybody.
Bill Ackman, one of the largest shareholders, Pershing Square, dumped their entire stake, 3.1 million shares. I mean, is there any relief in sight here?
Well, Netflix says that the, you know, COVID sort of obscured their business. They did really well during COVID. Everyone was stuck at home. And now that COVID is starting to end, they're saying there's other factors that are causing the subscriber decline. They point to things like 100 million people who are sharing other passwords and if they can get more of those people to start paying. You know, there's a lot of things that Netflix says it could do. And they're also introducing a lower cost ad-supported service, which is very interesting. Netflix had long said they would never have advertising, and now they're talking about a cheaper service with ads, and that's really an acknowledgement that they can't just keep raising prices, but if they want to keep growing, there's a part of the market that wants a cheaper service.
Now, on the other side, there's CNN Plus abruptly getting shut down less than a month after launch. I actually had a chance to sit down with Andrew Morse, who really launched this service, SVP at CNN. And here's what he had to say to me just a few weeks ago.
The beauty of a subscription service is if you create something of value, people will pay. We are so confident that we're building something of such value that people are going to be willing to give give up one cup of coffee a month to pay for the service.
So, Jerry, what happened? Why didn't Discovery give it more of a chance?
Well, I think this is largely a story about two media companies that had different strategies in streaming. CNN's parent, up until a couple weeks ago, Warner Media, felt that CNN could exist as a standalone streaming service. David Zaslav, who is the CEO now of Warner Brothers Discovery, the combined company, has been saying for several weeks that the their strategy is going to be one big streaming service that competes around the world with Netflix, and that really was a sign that CNN Plus did not fit into David Zaslav's vision.
Now, streaming news is something that no one's really cracked. I've heard a couple of analysts say over the last couple of days that Netflix needs streaming news and sports. Is that something that CNN and other streaming services are still going to need if they really want to rack up more subscribers?
Well, I mean, that was really what was so interesting about CNN Plus. Nobody had really tried to have a streaming service that people have to pay for news. And now, the fact that you know, Warner Brothers Discovery has pulled the plug on this so quickly, I think we still don't know what the market is, what the appetite is for a streaming service that you have to pay for. A lot of TV networks have streaming services, but they're all free. You know, there were some numbers that came out about CNN Plus's early subscribers, but it was still early. It was only a few weeks into the launch. And you know, for now, we are left wondering just how popular can a streaming service for news really be.
All right, a story we'll continue to follow. Bloomberg's Jerry Smith, thank you. Meantime, in other news, Sheryl Sandberg, Meta's COO, reportedly pressured a British newspaper not to publish a story about her then-boyfriend. According to the Wall Street Journal, on two occasions, Sandberg contacted the digital edition of the Daily Mail regarding reporting on Activision CEO Bobby Kotick and a restraining order taken out by his former girlfriend. Sandberg and Kotick reportedly worked with Facebook and Activision employees on this matter. Facebook is said to have begun a review of her actions. Okta has concluded its investigation of a security breach, saying the impact was far smaller than it could have been. The January 21st hack lasted for just 25 minutes, according to the company, and the hackers, which Bloomberg learned included a 16-year-old in England, had control of a single workstation from a third-party vendor. Just two customer systems were breached, far fewer than the 366 they initially thought. I'm joined now by Frederick Karist. He's the co-founder and COO of Okta, also out with a brand new book, Zero to IPO, over $1 trillion of actionable advice from the world's most successful entrepreneurs. Frederick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
So we're going to get to the hack, but I'll talk about the book first. There are a lot of books out there about entrepreneurship. You say they don't give you what you need when you're really in the trenches. What do they not have that your book does?
Well, I think one of the things for an entrepreneur is these books that are out there today, they just try and lionize what happened to other folks. And they walk through their lives and what happened and how they built their businesses and personally. What we're trying to do is demystify what happens in entrepreneurship. We're trying to get advice from the best entrepreneurs in the world, gathering all that advice in one place. And it's basically the field guide that I wish I had had when we started Okta 13 years ago.
You open with a story about Okta revenue flatlining in 2011. You're going into a board meeting. You think you're going to get fired and that the company is done. Instead, Ben Horowitz, one of your investors, calls you, and instead of firing you, he gives you some advice. What did he tell you that enabled you to turn the company around?
That's a great example of some of the actionable advice that I think too often doesn't get shared with entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs think that everything's a perfect journey, and when they look from the outside, all these companies are destined for glory. As you said, in 2011, Okta revenue basically flatlined, and Ben called and said a couple things. He said, first of all, you need to get help, and you need to hire leaders who have done this kind of thing before. And second of all, he said, you need to keep the main thing the main thing. In our case, it was focusing on the right go-to-market segment and pivoting to much larger organizations that actually have serious identity management opportunities and problems.
So it's Okta's 5-year anniversary, actually, this month, I believe, and it's been an incredible ride. Shares have gone way up. More recently, they've come a bit down from their peak. What is the hardest lesson you've learned in the 5 years since going public?
I think keeping a view on where you're going in the long term and reminding employees that we're building something that's important in a big market that matters to many people. So if you pay attention too much to the stock on a day-to-day basis, you might feel as though you're not sure you're focused on the right thing. But if you take the long view, look, we're in markets that are worth $80 billion. The company's $1.5 billion in revenue, growing 50% year over year, and we've set very clear benchmarks for FY26 of $4 billion of revenue with 20% FCF margins. If you keep a good view on that long-term perspective, I think we're going to be in great shape.
I'm sure you've learned a few lessons from the hack, and Todd, your CEO and co-founder, was recently on the show to talk about what happened. Take a quick listen to what he had to say.
We are a trusted brand, and that trust has been damaged. And we do take accountability for all the mistakes we've made. And we have made mistakes. And one of them, as you mentioned, is the communication was not as clear as it should have been.
What's the lesson here?
Well, there's a number of lessons. First of all, as the global leader in identity, we realize now and appreciate what critical infrastructure Okta is for our customers. And look, we take all security events very seriously. There's two things I want to clarify. First of all, the Okta service was not breached. Second of all, the Okta product did what it was supposed to do and actually prevented a major breach from happening. There's a number of things that we've learned here. I think, first of all, from a technology perspective, we need to make sure that our third-party partners are held accountable to the same standards we are. And then secondly, we have to improve communication. Look, we're a trusted brand, as Todd said, and our customers rely on us for communication and trust when it comes to the platform, what we say, and how we communicate with them. And that's paramount. So great learning opportunity for us, and things we'll certainly do better in the future.
How much harder will security and identity management be in Web3? And what is Okta's play there?
Yeah, well, Web3 obviously is exciting. It's a combination of both decentralization and modern advanced technology. Look, I think, frankly, identity could be a game changer on the blockchain. Think about you and I as consumers, information like health and credit. These are things that we should own and make sure the right people have access, not entrust them to third-party credit agencies who have breaches like we saw a couple years ago. The challenge and the opportunity in Web3, of course, is this is not just cutting-edge technology. This is bleeding-edge technology, and we really have to move it forward before it becomes mainstream.
Elon Musk making a play for Twitter. Yeah. What do you think?
I think it's very exciting as an entrepreneur. I mean, Elon Musk's track record stands for itself. I think this is an undervalued asset in Twitter. You compare it to Facebook, Meta, which is a graph of the people you know. It's important, but Twitter has a lot more critical information on what you care about and what you can follow. Now, I do think he's shaken things up, clearly. I think there's an opportunity for that board to be more involved in governance. But I think this might be Elon's Rupert Murdoch moment. If you think back to 1976 when Rupert Murdoch bought the New York Post, it gave him that first voice into broad media and communications. And I think that's what you're seeing right now with Elon.
Interesting, though he's unpredictable on any given day. Does that concern you?
Look, at the end of the day, Twitter is a huge megaphone for him. I mean, he has 82 million followers. It's clearly an underperforming asset. The S&P 500 has outperformed the Twitter stock over the last decade by a factor of 2-1. And frankly, there's a lot he could do with the business. If you separate out that technology business from the media part, you open source who can have access to that information, the question of moderation goes away. Let the capital markets decide how much moderation people want on their version of Twitter.
Well, in a not unlike Elon Musk move, you actually have another company that's focused on the brain, focused on curing brain disease. Can you talk to us a little bit about this?
Yes. It's a great company called Herophilus that we have 45 folks based here in San Francisco. We are focused on AI-empowered neurotherapeutics trying to cure central nervous system disease. Two major ones that we have breakthroughs on are Alzheimer's and Rett syndrome that are going into the clinic soon, and it's something I'm very excited about.
Interesting. Well, thanks so much for joining us and telling us about that and your new book, Zero to IPO, available now. Frederick Karas.
Thank you very much.
Okta. Thank you. Time for our crypto report now. Bitcoin jumping briefly past 42,000 and up since the beginning of the week, but still staying in that tight range. Our crypto contributor, Shanali Basik, here now for more. Not moving, Shanali. Why not?
Not moving. So much friction, Emily. When you take a look at it, we're back to where we really started the week again, pretty much. We were back down to 40,800, so a little higher than where we ended Monday, but back to where we were pretty much last week. I mean, we haven't moved at all in Bitcoin, but I want to show you something else because there are some long-term trends here about how people are using Bitcoin that are worth taking a look at, and that's settlements. Bitcoin surpassed Visa in the amount it's been settling with more than $13 trillion on chain, and a lot of that is due to the work on layer two protocols. So it's worth taking a look into how the Bitcoin and its networks are changing and facilitating more payments because that's going to be the adoption that drives the price later on.
All right, Shanali, thank you. Stick with us. I want to bring in our next guest, Kathleen Brightman, co-founder and CEO of the blockchain-based smart contract platform Tezos. Kathleen, what do you make of the fact that we're not seeing a lot of movement here in crypto markets? It's really trading along with traditional equities. You know, what does that have to say about the future of cryptocurrency?
Well, definitely rupture is one of the main narratives that people have been saying for many years, which is that Bitcoin is kind of this anti-correlated asset or uncorrelated asset to traditional equity markets. We've seen that that's not the case. We've also seen some things that were unexpected, especially with the beginning of the pandemic.
I'm curious, Kathleen, what you think about the conversation around Bitcoin versus Ethereum as everybody waits for the merge and the idea of proof of stake and what that might do to change how people interact with blockchain here.
Yeah, so there's a lot of things in that question. Bitcoin and Ethereum secure themselves through a mechanism called proof of work. Which has come under scrutiny as the technology has gotten more popular because, in effect, what it does is it consumes energy in order to secure the blockchain. Proof-of-stake networks do not do this, and they've been looked at since people have realized that Bitcoin is very energy-consumptive as an alternative, but there isn't one that's as popular as Bitcoin or Ethereum. Ethereum, of course, has been advertising itself as imminently transitioning to proof of stake since 2014, but it has failed to do so to date. So it's been a big debate, like, basically, do you value this technology enough to hold your nose and accept that it, consumes a lot of energy in most instances, or do you want to go to alternatives like Tezos, which don't use as energy consumption.
Yeah, and how do you think about that in terms of not just energy consumption, Kathleen, but in terms of transferring assets? There's been so much conversation this year about Lightning Network, for example, and the ability to facilitate payments over Bitcoin, but we've had a conversation internally. It's like you can do that more simply without another layer on Ethereum. So where does Tezos play into that conversation?
Yeah, so I think Tezos addresses a problem that both Bitcoin and Ethereum have been unable to solve, which is it has a formal governance mechanism for ratifying and instantiating upgrades to the protocol. So this happens on the fly. It happens seamlessly. In fact, it's happened 9 times without any drama. Adding to the technological capability of the blockchain itself. So I think, basically for this stuff to scale effectively, you need to have a formal governance mechanism that actually instantiates upgrades in a meaningful fashion. That's the way it would work if you, were thinking about this happening, at the order of millions or not billions of participants. And I think Tezos is the only blockchain that really addresses this issue of stasis in the code base. And so that's why I think it's, obviously the future. Bitcoin and Ethereum to date have had a lot of promising and a lot of under-delivering in terms of technical instantiations. And we've seen limitations of that over the last year or so when Ethereum has fallen under scrutiny for having a large energy consumption, but has still failed to upgrade itself to the proof-of-stake version that it's been promising since 2014.
Kathleen, Tezos is second only to Ethereum in Twitter NFT discussions in the art world, and I'm curious what you think about the prospect of Elon Musk owning Twitter.
It's certainly pound for pound in terms of entertainment value has not disappointed, as is Elon's wont. I think, basically Tezos right now feels like Greenwich Village in the 1960s. All the cool kids are hanging out there and minting a lot of art. It's just a matter of time before people see it. Twitter has been an excellent forum for discussion about this in the cryptocurrency space, where basically the project gets a lot of airtime that it wouldn't otherwise because of these discussions and the forum that's created. So I'm in for the Thunderdome Elon Musk version of Twitter, where allegedly censorship doesn't happen. I don't know what his gripe is, but it certainly has kept me on the site in terms of entertainment value and Matt Levine articles.
So good.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Shanali.
Yeah, sorry. I wonder also, what is the future of communicating about crypto? Is it some Twitter Discord mashup here? I mean, ultimately, there seems to be some need or want for a more social communication aspect to cryptocurrencies above and beyond just payments.
Yeah, I think a lot of these projects that are trying to do social alternatives on a blockchain or something like that have been mostly reactions from right-wing people who have been largely banned on Twitter. The problem with that is that they often say very odious things. So I do think there's like a sort of uncensored version of the web that is very promising. I do think that once it stops being championed by repugnant people that most of the place society doesn't really quite like, it'll actually take off.
Fascinating. Kathleen Brightman, co-founder and CEO of the blockchain-based smart contract platform Tezos, along with our own Shanali Bosak. Lots of food for thought there. Thanks. Crucial Crusoe Energy Systems, a crypto company taking waste gas from oil fields and harnessing it to power Bitcoin mining, just announced $350 million in new equity funding, providing new capital to accelerate their mission to align the future of computing with the future of the climate. I want to bring in Crusoe CEO and co-founder Chase Lockmiller now for more on this. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So this is gas that would otherwise not be used, right? Being used to power Bitcoin mining. How does it work?
That's correct. So what happens in the oil field is there's something called flaring. It's one of the largest emission sources from oil production. What happens is an oil company will drill an oil well, and one of the byproducts of that is natural gas. And if they don't have access to a pipeline, the best, most economic thing for them to do is just light it on fire. And when they do that, they end up actually venting quite a bit of the methane in the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And methane is a very potent greenhouse gas. It traps 82 and a half times more heat in the atmosphere than CO2. And so it creates this massive waste with no beneficial use, and everybody kind of loses in this situation.
So how do you then use it to power Bitcoin mining?
Sure. So Crusoe developed a technology called digital flare mitigation, where we build, operate, and manage these mobile modular data centers that we deploy into the oil field, and we co-locate on-site with the sites that would be flaring. And now instead of the gas being flared, it feeds into the digital flare mitigation systems to create low-cost computing infrastructure to power digital currency mining, high-performance computing, GPU cloud computing product, and things like artificial intelligence research.
You're running a pilot program using excess natural gas from Exxon in North Dakota. How's that going?
We actually can't comment on the relationship with Exxon. Just no comment on that for time being.
But can you tell us a little bit more about the process? I mean, certainly if you can rack up big partners, this could be quite powerful.
Sure. So flaring is a global problem, and the World Bank has this initiative to end routine flaring by 2030. Today, there's about 14 billion cubic feet a day that get flared with no beneficial use. To put it in context of, like, if we could capture all of that gas and harness it for computing, we could actually power the whole Bitcoin network eight times over. So, you know, it's a very, very large waste. It's enough to power all of sub-Saharan Africa. So, you know, it's a very, very significant amount of wasted gas globally. Today, we operate in the Bakken in North Dakota, as well as Colorado and Wyoming. But with this additional financing, we're planning to expand into markets like the Permian Basin in Texas, the Vaca Muerta down in Argentina, places like Abu Dhabi and Oman in the Middle East, where flaring, you know, has been a persistent challenge for many decades.
So longer term, what are the opportunities you see to, as you say, align the future of computing to the future of the climate?
Sure. So Crusoe's core mission is to align the future of computing with the future of the climate. What does that mean? For us, that means building large-scale climate-aligned computing infrastructure to solve the world's most energy-intensive computing problems. And, like, you know, digital currency mining is a great example, artificial intelligence research, high-performance computing. And if you look at many estimates, they sort of project that the global power consumption from computing is going to exceed 10% in the near term. And Crusoe's focus is trying to enable humanity to be able to benefit from all of those computing-led innovations that are going to come about from that without having to suffer the environmental consequences of sourcing that power in a non-climate-aligned capacity.
So let's say this doesn't happen. Is Bitcoin mining on a path to significantly hurt the climate?
Our focus is trying to ensure that that doesn't happen. So we...
But how, you know, given the way it's happening now, and there are plenty of people who've, you know, raised alarm about how Bitcoin is created, how much is the way that it happens now hurting the climate?
So I think Bitcoin mining as an industry is actually one of the cleanest power sourcing industries in the world. By many estimates, it's, you know, 50 to 60% of the total power powering the Bitcoin network is sourced in a climate-aligned, renewable, emission-reducing way, like digital flare mitigation. And you compare that to, you know, the standard grid that's you know, multiples of what the U.S. grid, for instance, is powered from a renewable perspective.
So if you can harness all of this, then you could probably power many more things than Bitcoin mining, right?
Correct.
So what else?
So we've recently launched the Crusoe Cloud, which is a high-performance GPU cloud service that's focused on delivering low-cost and low-impact computing solutions for people focused on AI research. We're working with amazing research universities like MIT to help researchers there discover the mysteries of the universe in a way that doesn't impact the climate and doesn't impact their pocketbook too much.
All right. Well, we'll be following the latest developments. Keep us posted on your progress. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Emily.
For joining us, Crusoe CEO and co-founder Chase Lockmiller. And that does it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology. We're going to be right back here tomorrow. Don't forget to check out our podcast. You can find it anywhere you get your podcasts, your Bloomberg Tech Daily News Roundup. I'm Emily Chang in San Francisco. This is Bloomberg.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.